This is Chad Weckler. This is the Art of the Hudson Valley. This is WGXC 90.7. My guest, Glenn, and I had a few seconds conversation, meant to be on air, but now we're up and running. And we also have a guest from Brooklyn, and that's Jelani Bandelli, and she's via Skype. So I'm going to call her right now. It's pretty cool. I've never done this before. Hey, Jelani.
Hi. Yes.
Well, good afternoon. This is our first meeting.
Yes, good afternoon, Chad. It's nice to meet you.
And by the way, Glenn is here.
Hi, Glenn.
Hey, Jelani, darling. How are you?
Wonderful, wonderful. How about you?
I'm having a great time, Chad. Such a welcoming host. I'm so thrilled to be here with him.
Wonderful, wonderful. Can you hear me just fine?
Sharp and clear.
Yes.
Oh. And a bit sexy, I must say.
All right, now. Well, I'm going to keep it that way, Chad.
All right.
Okay.
So we're here to celebrate a book that just launched just the other day. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. October 3rd.
And it's called From Fashion to Fine Art, The Tunstall Art Odyssey. I love that title. Jelani, did you come up with that?
Absolutely. I don't remember. Glenn, did I? Or was it kind of a collaboration? I don't really remember.
You definitely came up with the Tunstall Art Odyssey. Remember, we had some discussions about that. And
yeah.
From Fashion to Fine Art actually was something that was out there already that we were using back and forth. But the rest of it kind of filled out the whole sentiment of the book.
Yes.
And how did the two of you meet?
Well, that's an interesting story. I'd like to tell it.
Good.
Glenn and I, our paths had crossed many times, but we didn't really know that. We had both worked at Fairchild Publications. We had both spent time in Paris. And we lived in the same neighborhood in Brooklyn, but we hadn't met until the early 80s. I attended a party, and Glenn was also there, and we met, and we became fast friends. In fact, another friend that was there with me, that after that night, all we could talk about was Glenn, because his personality was just so charming and wonderful, and we really liked him, and we said, you know, we have to become friends with him, and we did, and that's how it happened.
I love your description, Watch. I've only known Glenn personally just for a couple of years, although our similar professional background goes much back further, but we never connected. But I love your word charming as a description.
Yes, it's true.
So, Glenn, you want to tell us how you got charming? Or did that reading your book, which is a story of your life, basically you go back to your beginnings in Detroit.
Yes.
So let's go back in the time machine and talk about Detroit growing up.
Well, I actually was born in New York, but my family moved to Detroit when I was about 8 years old. And I oftentimes think that I was destined to live in Detroit. It was a great time to be there. And we lived very near my father's relatives. I can remember always being fascinated with sketching and drawing as a kid. My aunt tells a story of every time she would see me, I would come over to her house and I'd fall out in the middle of the floor with a pencil and paper and just sketch and sketch. And it was something that I really enjoyed doing. I didn't realize that I had a talent. It was just something that I enjoyed. And one day I decided I was going to do this kind of test that they have in a magazine. It was titled Learn to Draw. And what they required was you to copy a sketch. So I copied a sketch and I sent it in to them. And it must have been good because they sent me back an extensive test that maybe we had about 12 pages or something. And I did variations of the images or whatever they requested. And it was just fun. It was just like a game for me. And I sent it back. And lo and behold, this guy shows up at my house, you know, trying to get me to join this art instruction school. But they were, up until that moment, I hadn't realized that there was a career in art. To me, it was just something you did because you enjoyed it. And he says to me, yeah, you can make money. I'm like, yeah. And he's like, yeah. And he says, so he went into the kitchen and he pulled out the cereal boxes and things like that. And he showed me magazine covers. He said, this is drawings. Somebody's getting paid to do this. And I got really excited. And of course, I wanted to join the school right then. But my parents were not quite as quick.
Yeah.
So ultimately, that went by the wayside. But the idea of drawing for a living never really left me.
Were there, at that time, you must have been attracted towards certain magazines, maybe? What were you looking at for inspiration visually?
Then, growing up in a black household, we always had like Ebony and Jet around. So those were for sure magazines that we had. I don't remember my mother necessarily having anything like Vogue. So I wasn't really oriented towards fashion at that time. It seemed, though, that that happened later once I got into Cass Tech High School. I tended to draw things like landscape type of things, and I had a particular penchant for drawing staircases. I just loved the challenge of drawing the steps going up and down and curving and landings going off to the left and off to the right. And as a result, I think I really sharpened my sense of perspective early on.
That was a great opportunity to learn that, because I think for anybody who draws, whether a draftsman or photographer or painter, you know, perspective is not always that easy.
No, it's not. And I had a course at Cass that was perspective drawing. And I remember my instructor saying, I could tell if a line is off in an instant.
So was it 1969 that you had the opportunity to go to Fashion Institute of Technology?
Yeah, it was 68 was when I graduated from high school, and I'd gotten this scholarship to go to FIT as an apparel designer.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, especially considering I wasn't interested in being a fashion designer. Mm. I was only interested in illustration. My real goal was to be a fashion illustrator and go to Parsons. And in the book, I talk about how I had a counselor that suggested ever so gently that I not apply to Parsons because he didn't think my work was good enough.
Ooh.
Yeah. So following his advice, I didn't. I applied to FIT, got the scholarship to FIT, and figured maybe he doesn't quite know what he's talking about. And it was only when I came to New York later, after missing the opportunity to go to FIT because of a car accident and left me in the hospital, I made the journey to New York with a walking stick, got rid of my crutches and used a walking stick. And with my friend Dwight Johnson, we went to Parsons, the place that I'd always wanted to go. And right there on the spot, I knew this is where I had to be. So I made an application right there at that moment. And a few weeks later, after I got home, there was an acceptance letter.
Oh, dream come true.
Yes.
That not only did he go to Parsons at that time, but he's still there. Just in a different capacity.
I agree. Say, I finally did graduate from
he didn't repeat grades
for 30 years, 40 years. Yes, I am still, I am teaching there now. Thank you, Jelani.
Mm-hmm.
And aren't you also teaching elsewhere? Do you have another?
Yes, I'm also teaching at Marist College right now.
You don't slow down.
Well, I don't know if there's very much option for slowing down. We all just keep going, don't we?
Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
And Jelani, when Glenn is telling his story for this book, I'm sure you knew a lot of the story matter. I'm taken to the 1970s, which Glenn is really working hard.
Mm-hmm.
Makes money, loses money, goes to Europe, loses money, makes money, travels around the world, meets people, and never gives up.
Exactly. And it was just the way you describe it is quite wonderful. It was a story that you had to really hold the reins on because there's so much going on. And when trying to tell it, there's a lot there, as just as you described it. The travel back and forth, the ups and downs. And that was one of the challenges of putting Tunstall from Fashion to Fine Art together, because there's so much to tell. There's so much to tell.
I was so pleased that with Jelani's efforts, because she just kind of really saw a vision for it, how the story really could be rolled out. And she would ask me questions to help define my the story itself, so that there was more clarity, so that we could understand the sequence. I don't think that the book would have gotten written, certainly published, if it hadn't been for her very great, great efforts.
Thank you.
And when you came to New York, Brooklyn, went to Parsons, weren't you taking work along with going to school? Or did you just go to school to learn fashion illustration or the illustration?
Well, when I was at Parsons, it was strictly just going to school. Mm-hmm. It wasn't great because I didn't really have very much money to live on. So ultimately, I wind up having to leave Parsons to get a job to survive. But while I was at Parsons, I mean, the curriculum was so strenuous that you really didn't have time to do part-time jobs and things like that.
And what would you call your very first substantial break into the fashion illustration field?
That was Simplicity Patterns. I had all my friends looking out for any opportunities for me. And I remember after spending a day going on some job interviews that I didn't seem to be qualified for, I got home and my friend Linda Merritt, who lived across the hall from me, came running across the hall with the New York Times and said, "I found a job for you in the New York Times." And it was Simplicity Pattern book. And I went to the interview and they liked my work. At that time, I was still carrying a portfolio from Parsons, so it was like huge 18 by 24 drawings on newsprint and everything else. And the designer said to me, "We like your work, but we'd like you to do a sample for us in the size that we would use," which is like 8.5 by 11. And I said, "Okay." And he leaned in close to me and he said, "If you really want this job, you'll do 2. And I went home and I did 3. And I came back the next day and I got the job.
There you go.
And my first lesson ever was always produce more than expected.
Yes. And I think that's great advice for everybody in any field. If they say show up at 1, you're there at 12:30. Yeah. You know, they ask for one, you produce three.
Right, exactly. And it's been a part of my career since then. I've always produced for the presentation.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And what was that job at Simplicity? What were you required to do?
Well, I was so pleased when I got the job. It was like my dream job. And the job I was supposed to do was do sketches of the clothing. It was like samples for their catalog, what they were going to submit to their catalog artists to produce for the actual book. So I was supposed to do sketches. My problem was that I was so young and so creative that I couldn't hold it down. So I was drawing every kind of thing I could think of. I mean, just trying to make it fun and interesting, mm-hmm. not knowing that you had to really, not realizing, I should say, that you had to really focus it towards the customer at hand. Mm-hmm. So my girls with the multicolored hair and the articulated movements and things like that were well beyond their desire.
Yeah.
So every week I would get called in by the design director threatening to fire me or always giving me another illustrator's work and say, can't you draw like this? Mm. Can't you draw like him? And it became so frustrating that I had to start looking for another job.
And where did you go from there?
There was an interesting tie-in because I stayed there for a while, but in my search for other work, I was inadvertently introduced to Steven Cervantes, who was a very well-known fashion illustrator that worked for Women's Wear Daily. So I met him, went up to Women's Wear to meet him, and we became fast friends. And as a result, I developed an association with the other artists at Women's Wear. And he introduced me and kind of like exposed me to a lot in the world of fashion and culture and film and things like that. But he also introduced me to people at Vogue Patterns who I ultimately wound up working for through those introductions.
So you did the almost a complete round of pattern designers, Simplicity, Butterick and Vogue.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, I worked on the inside, and later when I started working at Women's Wear, a few years after that, as a matter of fact, they started hiring me, all of them, to do their catalog work as well. So now I was on the other side of it. Uh-huh. I was no longer correcting art or coloring art or doing presentation samples. I was now the illustrator for the book.
So I'd like to segue into Women's Wear Daily. And Jelani, pop in anytime.
Because
I'm looking towards you to tell me some stories that did not make it into the book. That because it's a great story of Glenn's history, but there's got to be some missing pieces that we'd like
well,
to.
I'm sorry, Chad. Yeah, I'd like to. There is a piece from something we were talking about earlier, and I think it leads up to this inability to control his creativity that he spoke mm-hmm. about at Simplicity, and early on. One of the things that I've discovered while we were working on the book is that Glenn loved to draw things very elaborately. Mm. So, and you begin to see that show up in his fashion work, but you also see it show up in his paintings as well. And he describes being a child that moved around quite a bit with his family, and because he's very shy, he would always use drawing as a way of introducing himself to other children. And so they would stand around him and watch, and he would draw these elaborate images of Cleopatra in full regalia and things like that. So I think that once he was at Simplicity and he could not control that artistic ability, and clearly sometimes there are environments where you are not allowed to do that, when he went to Women's Wear Daily, the door opened wide, and in that position, he was allowed to do all of that, and he did.
And I'd like to have Glenn talk about Women's Wear Daily, you know, in the title is daily. And describe for our listeners what Women's Wear Daily meant to you and what it, you know, it means to the fashion industry.
At that time, Women's Wear Daily had kind of changed from its earlier incarnation as kind of a trade magazine that talked about, you know, fibers and you know, and just the production of apparel to a kind of fashion style publication. And it really focused, it turned its focus on the design of fashion and the high fashion at that. So by the time I got to Women's Wear, it was already lauded as like the fashion Bible. And it was the Bible because it printed every day, and every day there was something about the industry globally. So you went to it. You didn't have the internet at that time. You didn't have any other competing publications that were able to produce on a daily basis what was and was totally dedicated to the world of fashion. And go ahead, Jelani.
I'd like to also add here that at that particular time at Women's Wear Daily, it was not only was it the fashion Bible, but all of the disciples were there. The creme de la creme of fashion illustrators were there all at the same time.
Yeah.
Which is a very interesting place.
As well as you had some of the most renowned fashion editors there as well.
That's true.
So the doors opened wide when you for Women's Wear Daily. And for me to wind up in a position to walk through those doors as a member of that crew was just the most incredible thing to happen in my life, you know, up to that point. And I think that I was so thrilled with having received the opportunity to work there that it had never dawned on me that I would be the first black artist that they ever had. Mm-hmm. Work there. And it kind of went back to something that rung true to the world of fashion. And that is, if you had talent, they wanted to work with you. Okay. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I found that you had to get past the first floor, usually the reception, to get to where you're really appreciated. Many a times, one of the things that they had us do at Women's Wear would be go into the market, as they called it, to sketch and work directly with the designers or the manufacturer for something that would be printed in the paper, which was gave a lot of status to the manufacturers. And oftentimes, I would get to some of these buildings and I couldn't even get upstairs. They'd take one look at me and they say the messenger's entrances are outside and around the corner and in the back. Mm. And when I tell them, you know, sometimes when I tell them that I'm there to see such and such or so and so, I'd be met with resistance. And it really would depend on how much I felt like fighting that day, whether I would just acquiesce and go to the messenger's entrance, or rather I'd call up and have them send someone down. But it was, you know, it was off-putting.
Yes.
And not necessarily the best way to make an acquaintance in the design department.
Daunting times.
Yeah, it was transitions, you know, and I guess I was just part of that transition.
But
and you know what else, Chad, I'd like to jump in here
is
it was also what was also interesting about that period was I can't remember any other period being like this one, in which we had five or six prominent African-American fashion designers all at once.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of any other period that has been this way. And so there was this dichotomy happening. As, you know, Glenn described, everything was working fine high up, but you had to get past the first floor first. So that's what to me is in large part makes his experience and his story so interesting, because as you've read in the book, the things that he's done, the world travel, the working for all of the top, not only fashion designers, but retailers as well, but doing it all in the midst of all this other stuff that was going on in the culture.
And I agree with both of you there. Maybe it was the 1960s that helped promote openness, but certainly my experience, and it sounds like for both of you, in the 1970s in fashion, and Glenn, I totally agree, it was talent first. And there was a tremendous amount of talent, and people were, and the industry was growing. You know, fashion illustration was at a terrific point in its life. Fashion photography had its place, but in all the major, I would say, newspapers and magazines, you know, if Lord & Taylor didn't add, if Bloomingdale's didn't add, it was fashion illustration, which is not the case anymore.
And what was interesting about these was the imaging for each of these retailers was remarkably different, because you had an illustrator and their way of sketching that was made the ad stand out uniquely different from the others. With the advent of the photography, you started to see a sameness in the imaging, and the things that really made them different was the logo at the bottom of the ad. And I feel like there's a real loss. And in addition to that, I think that when fashion illustration is a form of art, and it was a daily form of art, and it was something that people looked at and interpreted and had an opportunity to really connect to art. Mm-hmm. And now you just don't see that. And I don't know if that hasn't had some impact on our society.
When I was driving over here, I thought that back in the heyday, or maybe it is still the case, usually fashion catalogs were photography, which I think was meant for the consumer to actually purchase go to the store or purchase by telephone or online. And the fashion illustration in the newspapers was to entice the customer to get the catalog. So it's my opinion that the fashion illustration was much more important to the company to get customers.
Well, certainly the imaging could be very enticing, and you could just kind of dream with a fashion image. What happened in many ways was the original use was because of production and technical issues around printing photography. It just didn't work in newspapers, and up until a certain point, it didn't even work in magazines. But once photography became a part of the imaging, I just think the sameness took away the imagination. And so what they wound up doing is they had to start making it more about the models. And in came the supermodels. And on the heels of supermodels came celebrities. So now you have celebrities, and you hardly know what they're wearing because you're really paying more attention to their face. Mm.
So back to the 70s, you were primarily working in New York City, but you started to want to move out of the country. And in the book, there's a story of you going to Paris and meeting Antonio. And Antonio was a very well-known artist and illustrator. What was that meeting like and that change in your life?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Antonio Lopez, who currently is on exhibit at a show in Manhattan at El Museo de Barrio, was an exciting personality as well as an exciting artist. And he kind of changed the look of fashion illustration. He kind of started to represent the youth movement, but also the ethnicity that exists in the world of fashion that hadn't started appearing in the world of in the magazines until he started doing it. And I remember going to Club Set. It was a very famous fashion kind of dance club where all the great designers hung out every night. And my friend Alvachin, who was a model, a very popular model at that time, took me there. And it was a very small club with an upstairs and a downstairs. And the upstairs were where people like Saint Laurent would sit with his crew and have dinner all evening. And downstairs was the mirrored dance floor and bar. And I'm going downstairs, and I run right into Antonio. I'd only heard about him and read about him and admired his work up until that point. And I immediately said, "You're Antonio." And, you know, I couldn't think of anything else. and he was like very warm, and I told him my name, and I was really surprised that he recognized my name from Women's Wear. And so it was like the meeting of two minds. So we just sat down and just started talking and talking and talking. And I could see that he had been so embraced in the European fashion world that and he had kind of stood out on his own as an illustrator and not as, let's say, a part of an illustration team, mm-hmm. as I was at the Women's Wear team. And I wanted that for myself. And right there in that moment, my idea of moving to Europe blossomed.
And how long? Well, you made some different trips here and there.
Yes.
Now you're setting down roots, but back then the roots, they went out.
Yeah, you know, when I told them at Women's Wear I was leaving, they were like shocked. It was like the creme de la creme job, and here you are getting ready to walk away from it. Are you crazy? And I'm thinking, I'm going to Europe, and I'm gonna be famous, you know. And so I was kind of like. And at the same time, part of the problem at Women's Wear was I was getting so much work from the freelance that I was doing, and I was also concurrently working with Vogue magazine. So I would work in the morning at Women's Wear, go to Vogue at lunch, come back, finish at Women's Wear, and then go home and do freelance. And this was every day, and I was really getting worn out. And so when I left Women's Wear, I literally moved to Morocco, thinking that I was retiring at 25.
Well, you know, I think also too, Chad, the meeting with Antonio held a lot of interest for me when we were working on the book, in that it was really a telling of Glenn's future story, because one of the things that Antonio, I don't think he directly said it to you, Glenn, but it was implied that there was life after Women's Wear.
Mm.
And that there was something else that you would be able to do. And I think that that conversation, even though it wasn't something that happened right then, played a very important part in Glenn's future story as a painter.
And I get the feeling from the book that Glenn had a great circle of friends.
Yes.
And the fashion industry, at least for you, Glenn, sounds like it was almost all collaborative and no competition. Would that be correct?
No, that would not be correct.
Okay.
There was a lot of competition, and nowhere did you feel it more than in the studio at Women's Wear, where every artist would look at your work with a very critical eye as they looked at their own and as they looked at everyone else's. Women's Wear was like a repository of fashion art from every illustrator that you can imagine. And we were critical of their work as much as we were critical of our own.
I think one of the great things about fashion illustration at that time, especially if it was in Women's Wear Daily or newspapers, that the artist was able to attach their name to the artwork. And that's, I mean, you were becoming famous because people were seeing your name on works of what I would call art. Photography, you know, for the most part, photographers became anonymous unless it was an editorial spread in a magazine. So no wonder Antonio knew you and knew your work.
Well, I had a byline at Women's Wear, and in most cases, even for retailers, when you did work, you could sign your name. And, yeah, so you got famous. I mean, I was receiving fan mail. I would go places and people would recognize me. And I'm like, how are you going to recognize me?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up, Chad, because I hadn't thought about that. But now I'm connecting it to something recent. There's a couple in London who are enthusiasts about fashion illustration, and they've been doing they have a gallery called Graham CA, and they held a show in which two of Glenn's vintage illustrations were included a couple of years ago, and we went to London for that, and it was amazing to meet all of the other illustrators who were there, because it was all work from that era and all of it was signed. And so when they began to talk to one another, everyone was kind of, oh, I remember this, or I remember you from that. So it created, there was this whole community there. And you could see that it was there back in the 70s. And you could see when everyone comes together that it's still that much that way now. And Glenn was just in another show there this past September. And Glenn, was it the same kind of feeling once again as it had been 2 years ago?
Yes, for the illustrators that were living, there were a lot of illustrators' works that have since passed on, but the reverence for one another's works was still there, and you know, I mean, it was almost like some of these images. It was just, they're just so overwhelmingly beautiful, because as an illustrator, you know what the draftsmanship is. You know how difficult it is to make something seem effortless and at the very same time have it be so completely informative.
They're talking about technique, because as an illustrator, unlike a photographer, you have to make texture on the paper. And one of the stories in the book, which I like, is you didn't have the experience of illustrating fur. And which, you know, it's not easy, along with, you know, all kinds of fabric, is how do you make it artistically show on two-dimensional work? Was that at Bergdorf?
Actually, this was for Alexandra Furs. I got a call to do their ads for the New York Times. And Stanley Schumann, who was the head of the company, took me aside and basically gave me this, like, this major education about furs. And as I tell my students today, every time you draw a line, it's you're describing something. But to do that effectively, you have to know what it is you're describing. So he helped me really understand what the differences in the furs were and why, as well as how they were produced, and so that they could create this look. And from that, I really have a very strong appreciation for furs and a real skill set in drawing and painting them.
And the book, which is, it's not really a picture book. It's words and images, which I really enjoyed going through. And I like seeing the black and white work, the color work. You know, we're going to segue into the fine art section, but I think as a fashion illustrator, I think you were a fine artist, because I think what you were doing and what a lot of other illustrators were doing were, like in the 19th century, fashion illustration was just straightforward. People in America could see something that was at a department store or something in Europe. And then in the early 20th century, you had people like Leyendecker. People were starting to add story to the work. And I think fashion illustrators of your era were doing the same thing, storytelling.
And that storytelling is very evident in Glenn's Playbill era, when he was doing the illustration for Playbill, which theater goers would receive. And those illustrations, when you look at them, they are very much, very, very storytelling.
I was definitely influenced by Leyendecker and Fellows, and especially the menswear illustrators. They always seem to put the men in these, you know, glamorous settings. In the 50s, it was a little bit simpler in the style, but unless you were like an Eric or a Boucher, where just that line quality just put you in a mood. But I always try to set a mood with the sketches. And, as you look through the book, you would see the transitions, the differences from one phase to another, where I gave a lot of detail in that area, and then later where there was none.
Then there's a little section in the book that you were involved in collage making and also mobiles.
Yes. That was in concert with my partner then, Toy Sanderson, who had moved to Europe and with me. And we just did all this trip in Morocco and Liberia. And coming back to Paris, we started working on collages. Toys had always been more in the fine arts arena, and it was interesting because we decided to bring his fine arts sensibilities into the fashion art that we were doing in Europe. And it led to some really powerful work, very beautiful work, fashion and fine art. And as a result, we did these collages that turned out to lead to an introduction to Romare Bearden, who was the probably preeminent collagist then and now. He's just an incredible man who kind of took us under his wing and invited us to his studio on Canal Street and to events and things. We wound up being in a show with him, or alongside him, at the U.S. mission to the U.N., which was an amazing experience, you know, to hang on a wall next to Romare Bearden. And he was always very, very helpful and with us and helping us better describe what it is we want to say using the materials we're using.
Was there any influence there with Toys and the introduction, the putting the seed in your head about fine art? When did you sort of want to make that transition?
Toys did help me realize that there was a world in fine art. At that moment, it wasn't time for me to make that transition. As we separated, he went full steam ahead into it. For me, it took longer to make a change. I'm not a quick change person. I'm more of an evolutionary changed person.
That's true. That's true. It took 2 years of evolution to get me to convince him to do this book.
This book would not be happening if it wasn't for Jelani's mantra. You know, you
must do a book.
Well, no, it was like, you have to tell your story. You know, you have to provide provenance for your work. People need to know where this all comes from. Hmm. You know, and that was a very convincing story. And too often we have stories that go untold. And the reason is we don't tell them.
That exactly. And, you know, Chad, I consider myself to be a legacy advocate. And it's probably to an extreme. It's at the point now where friends are probably hiding from me because and they're hiding from the inevitable question of when are you going to write your book? But I think it is very important. It's also important that we tell our stories while we're alive so mm-hmm. that we can, other people can still talk to us about it and that we can be an inspiration to others. And it's just a very important thing to do. So I'm glad that Glenn finally came around because he has a wonderful story to tell and it will continue to get better.
Yes. And it's one of these type of things like, you know, we all live our lives and we do what we do and things come out of them, hopefully for the best. I feel like I've went through a lot of changes and made a lot of decisions and in an industry that is really not necessarily the easiest to succeed in. And I just feel like especially young artists who may have been told they're not good enough or they shouldn't try or that it's too hard or whatever, I hope that my story kind of allows them to see that there's, if they have a dream, it's very important for them to go for it.
Mm-hmm. And you know what else? The other thing that we thought about when we were working on the book that it's a beautiful book with beautiful pictures in it and a very wonderful story, but the inspiration of the story is what really, really counts here to, as Glenn said, inspire a young artist and to allow them to know that there is life and money to be made in this pursuit, but to also help their parents. If you talk to a lot of students in art school, they don't have a lot of support and that sort of thing from their parents because they would rather see them go to law school or medical school or, you know, pursue some other kind of career that they believe has a little more, that's a little more assured. And this, I think, someone like that reading this book, a parent like that, can begin to see that supporting their child's endeavors is a good thing. Because there is somewhere to go here, and there's some place to do well as both an illustrator and as a painter.
Yeah, I totally agree, Jelani. I think the idea of creativity is sometimes lost on adults and schools. Yeah. It's not just it's in the thinking, it's in the making, but it crosses into every single profession and way of life.
Yes, it does. And, you know, Chad, there are even adults who I hope, you know, will read Tunstall from Fashion to Fine Art and be inspired because there are a lot of adults that are walking around with an artist inside of them that they were not able to pursue because of the very things I stated earlier. So the book is there to encourage them as well.
So, Glenn, we've got a little over 5 minutes, which is great. I wish we had more time, but getting to the fine art and you moving, you spent a lot of time in Martha's Vineyard.
Vineyard,
and you live in the Hudson Valley.
Yeah.
You spend time in South America, and wherever you go, you sketch, you paint.
Yes.
And it's not just one technique that you use. You use numerous ways to paint or watercolor or oil.
Well, when I originally started doing the fine artwork. It was really because the fashion work had kind of slowed up. Photography had taken over. And so I started traveling. I had met my husband, Joe Steele, and he had a penchant for traveling, and I enjoyed going anywhere with him. And
he's a lot of fun.
Yeah. And we would be in these settings, and rather than take a photograph, I would do like a quick watercolor sketch as a remembrance, because I could, you know. And I found that I got better at it, and I did more and more of it. And ultimately, I wound up thinking, I've got all these paintings. No one's ever seen them. Why don't I do a show? So I set up a show, and we set up a show in the studio, my studio in Brooklyn. We had friends, invited our friends. The friends came over, and they bought everything. And it wasn't expected. We had no sense that they would buy these works like this, and they basically took everything. And it was such an exciting experience that I suddenly realized I had a new career. And so we continued to travel a lot. I continued to do paintings. We continued to mount exhibits, but in different places in New York and everything. And it wasn't until we got to Martha's Vineyard, started doing paintings there, that I had a show at Linda and Hassan Minor's house. And they basically introduced us to the vineyard circuit, the crowd, you know. And from there on, I've been doing a show at Cousin Rose Gallery every year, a solo exhibit. And it's been wonderful. And the work has morphed. It's no longer just kind of locational watercolors. It's now oil paintings that I've been doing. And I've been developing a technique that I like to call dashlism, which is based on the style of the Impressionists, and most specifically the pointillists, and but they did points and I do dashes, thereby being the big distinction.
Jelani, how did you when you look at Glenn's fine artwork, what is your take on it? What inspires you? What attracts you to it?
His love of how he handles the sky. That is the thing that I always find amazing. There are, because you can actually see the life in it. It's not just this different shades of blue with clouds, but there's actually movement that you can see. I love the way he uses color. It's interesting because I saw Glenn's fine art before I ever saw his illustration. And I love the artwork. I love the use of color, as I said, the sky movement. But when I saw illustration, I didn't know what to do. When I saw the illustrations, I was, because it was so different. And I think that's the thing that I find most interesting about Glenn as an artist, is that you could do these two things that are so completely and totally different. Because if you put them side by side, you would never think that the same person had done them. And in fact, I think this year when on the vineyard, someone had seen an illustration and they said, oh, well, why is that there? That isn't your work. And Glenn said, yes, it is. And that person's face looked exactly like my face looked the first time I saw a different form of art from him. And to me, that speaks of someone really being a true artist, that you can do two things that are that different and do them both well.
I think, you know, definitely from the images in the book, the color illustrations, I do see that transition. I can see, you know, Glenn's fine artwork, that the color is in that transition. He has that love of color.
It's actually we did these series of drawings for that appeared in Italian Vogue, 12 pages, and they there's elements in it that look like my dashlism today. It was just really amazing when I look back on it that those elements were there then.
You know, Chad, I had started to look at when we were working on the book, and I had Glenn pull out a ton of illustrations. And as I began to look at them, earlier things were very much about the line, as illustration should be. But as I began to look further and further through the portfolios, I started to see fashion illustrations that actually look like paintings. And so I think that even without his own knowing, at some point Glenn was making that transition, but still doing it within the illustration, which is why you, as you say, you see the work, the paint, the fine artist in the illustration as well.
And I can't get can't leave the two of you hanging with not telling us what is next. Glenn, your website, what's happening with the book? Where is it available?
Well, we're doing a book signing of the book on October 23rd. That's Wednesday, October 23rd. 26th. I'm sorry. Thank you, Jelani.
Yeah, 26th.
At the Fashion Institute of Technology at their Barnes & Noble bookstore on, is that 27th Street?
In yes.
Manhattan? Mm-hmm.
Yes, 27th between 7th and 8th.
Yes, and the book is, Jelani, want to say something?
Well, one of the other things that we have, we've designed this branded book signing event, and it's called Tunstall Odyssey Live. So you have the Odyssey in the book, but if you come to the event, you'll actually have a live presentation where we will both be talking. You'll get to see some of the artwork. And those are, as I said, it's the branded event. So people are doing them in their homes or their place of business with a small, intimate group of people who they invite. So if anyone would be interested in hosting such an event, they can certainly contact us via email. And that's at tstudiopubs@gmail.com. And then if you're interested in seeing more of Glenn's work, you can do that at tunstallstudio.com. And there's also a sales site for his work, and that's tunstallstudio.net. And we'd love for you to follow us on social media as well for the book. And we're on Facebook, Instagram, and Pinterest.
You're almost doing the literary form of music house concerts.
Yeah, and it's the intimacy is very important, and again, that the design of this event actually came out of our idea about this book being an inspiration for young people and adults as well that we had talked about earlier. And when you're inspiring people, you have to get close to them. And this kind of, it's one thing to have these big giant events at stores or halls, and that, but the intimacy can happen in a smaller event like this where people can actually talk with you and ask you questions and that sort of thing. And we're hoping that at some of these events, people will bring young people with them.
Great idea. And, Jelani Bendelli.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Glenn Tunstall.
Thank you, Chad.
This has been a fantastic hour. I'm glad to have you both on WGXC to talk about your combined work, your project. So
thank you so much.
I'm going to be signing off. Thank you both. And this has been the Art of the Hudson Valley. I'm your host, Chad Weckler. I'll see you in another month. Thank you for listening. And on to more WGXC programming.